controversial new recommendation to arm teachers in Florida classrooms is out this week. Mayor Curry attacks a potential challenger before she even files to run. And medical marijuana, it's on the rise here in Florida. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning, and thanks for listening. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, it's our first Friday Media Roundtable of the new year. Lots to talk about from the week. You can get on the line now and join us. Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, have you heard of nanomarketing? If you haven't, we'll fill you in. The growing popularity of influencer marketing here in Northeast Florida and how businesses are using it. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy news week, the first news week of 2019. We welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sherry McGill is here. She's the editor of Jack's Lookout. Hey, Sherry.
Hey, Melissa.
Shelton Hull, columnist at Folio Weekly, joins us.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And David Cotton of the Jack's Daily Record.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, David. Good to have you guys here. Lots to discuss this week. Everything from school safety in Florida to the latest intrigue in the Jacksonville mayor's race and more. But our top story this Friday, a controversial recommendation to arm teachers in the classroom. Well, it's part of a new report that came out this week on the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School last year. Now, the MSD Public Safety Commission report also says not enough Florida school districts are taking the issue of school security seriously. They also found fault with several actors in Parkland, Florida, that led to the tragedy at MSD High School. So what does this mean for us? Of course, there's a lawsuit here in Jacksonville protesting the use of armed safety assistants in Duval County Public Schools. Now, though, the official commission report into that shooting is saying teachers should be armed in addition to armed safety assistants. What should we make of this? And let us know, what do you think of this proposal to arm teachers in your child's classroom? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jacks. And let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. Okay, David Cotton, let's begin with you. A controversial proposal out that teachers who volunteer to do this and undergo the training should be allowed to carry guns in the classroom. At the same time, we're seeing this lawsuit progressing in Duval County, where parents and the League of Women Voters of Florida are saying, we don't want armed safety assistants patrolling the hallways or campuses of local public schools. Teachers also are saying they don't want to be armed in the classroom. So what about that?
Well, I think what we're doing is we're increasing security, and we're sending a message that we acknowledge our schools are not safe. And instead of, you know, putting proper funding in place for other things, other school hardening measures, we are, you know, sort of caving to what is essentially an NRA lobby in Tallahassee that, you know, wants to expand gun ownership, guns in classrooms, guns in schools, guns in public places. And again, I think with Duval County, it's going to be hard. We are such a big district. It's such an expensive district. Where's the money going to come for this stuff to do it properly?
There's this state mandate, Sherry McGill, that Duval County is trying to meet by hiring armed safety assistants. It would cost a lot more to arm police officers to patrol campuses. So this is sort of the compromise that Duval County has hit on. You know, at the same time, as David pointed out, with buried within the findings of this report is the recommendation to invest more in prevention, invest more in mental health and behavioral health services for students. That's getting somewhat lost in all of this.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you raised that, Melissa. I read the report last night, and most of it is about communication, what failed, how the sheriff's department responded, et cetera, et cetera. A minor part is about arming teachers. What's interesting to me is the Duval County plaintiffs who are asking the court not to allow Duval County to arm these assistants. Their argument is that under state law, only police officers can be on a school property with a gun. So, you know, it's interesting to me how this plays out. Obviously, the state will have to change the law if we're going to allow Duval County to arm these assistants.
Shelton Hall, oh yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
No, but you're quite right. Most of the report is not about arming teachers.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Yes, most of this report is not about the idea of arming teachers, but Sherry is right, Shelton, in that state law would have to be changed to allow teachers who went through the training program to carry a concealed weapon on campus.
Yeah, well, you know, frankly, I'm skeptical of anyone who gets up that early in the morning for that kind of money. Most of the teachers I know are not only are they resistant to this idea, they're terrified.
Right.
My friends who are teachers are
not
really
in favor of it
because they know what goes on there. At the same time, I can kind of see the NRA's point, because one thing that comes through in the Parkland report is that, you know, Nicholas Cruz, the shooter, there were 49 police calls on him, and nothing was done to stop him from getting guns. We have an issue with, as David mentioned, this NRA, this gun lobby, that is using fake news and false stereotypes and whatnot to push these dangerous weapons onto the mentally ill. And then when they inevitably crack up, we use that as an excuse to arm people even more. Now, when you look at what Duval County is looking to do, one possibility might be reaching out and bringing in some of our veteran community to take up some roles as these police resource officers. But then, I mean, not to be pessimistic about it, but if we arm teachers in the state of Florida, I think everyone knows exactly what's going to happen.
Parents will pull their children out of these schools.
Yeah.
That is a given.
And they'll be running screaming out of the schools from their armed teachers.
The State Teachers Union and the PTA, let's be clear, vehemently oppose this proposal to arm teachers. They say that will make school campuses more dangerous.
We've had multiple examples in the past few years of video shot by students of school administrators and school security officers being besieged, hit, attacked during little student riots going on. What if that person was packing a pistol? We've also seen multiple instances of trained police officers who lose their guns if they're in a face-to-face confrontation with mm-hmm. a suspect who grabs it. So that's a major concern. Also, the report does indicate that police officers seem to take a lot more time than maybe necessary to prep, to suit up, or to scope out the situation in Parkland while this young man was in there and reloading multiple times.
Okay, let me also add that I think that we need to stress that so much of the conversation since Parkland has been about hardening these targets, these schools, making them a harder target. And so little effort has been put into the other part of this equation, which is strengthening the student's family, helping students who are vulnerable, who are mentally unbalanced, and preventing their easy access to weaponry in the first place.
I think you hit it right on the nail there. I mean, Nicholas Cruz should never have fallen through the cracks like he did, considering what we know about him now and his past and the months and weeks leading up to that. But, you know, that's what happens with you know, public schools here in Florida is especially now with Ron DeSantis as the governor-elect. We've got Richard Corcoran, who's now going to be, you know, in charge of education in the state of Florida. They are going to prioritize, instead of funding schools the way they should be, they're going to prioritize, you know, quote-unquote hardening and, you know, school choice. So we'll see those dollars go elsewhere.
Let's go to your calls now here on our first Friday Media Roundtable of 2019. It's 549-2937 to join us. Jeffrey in Jacksonville. Hey, Jeffrey, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question. One thing that comes up, you know, over and over again is arming teachers to harden these soft targets. Nobody really ever talks about the pay situation with these teachers. So my question is, you know, if we are going to arm teachers, are the same people who are advocating for that willing to pay them more to be armed? I'm a combat veteran, and I was paid more to be in a combat zone than I would, you know, in a garrison. And so it makes sense that, you know, if we are going to arm these teachers, that they ought to get paid more to be armed. But are they actually willing to go, you know, through funding our education system in order to do that? So I'll take my question.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Jeffrey. And what an incredible state of affairs where we're talking about a scenario that teachers basically are having to view their workplace as a combat zone. Mm-hmm. It's really, I'm almost beyond words as we talk about this.
Yeah, Melissa, I mean, you know, education, and particularly with elementary school children, human beings love to learn. We know that about little people especially. We're taking a school and creating a culture of fear as opposed to a culture of excitement and learning. I think that's, for me, the saddest part of this.
It is
very sad.
Oh,
I'm going to go to school now where I'm going to go through all these drills.
Mm-hmm. Which are traumatizing young students, mm-hmm. by the way.
Yeah. I would think so.
Yes. The young students, it's been studied nationally, have been deeply traumatized by the constant active shooter drills, the mm-hmm. lockdowns. Little kids shouldn't have to feel afraid when they go to school.
Right. And it's leading to a crisis of credibility in our schools, because you're getting a lot of students thinking, okay, well, if the teachers are getting armed and the police are getting armed, maybe I should have a weapon in my vehicle too, which, as we've seen with the gun lobby, they're pushing very hard for open carry on college campuses. We've already got that, I believe, up in Georgia. They've been trying to push that here in Florida. And to get to the caller's question, will teachers be paid more? The answer is no. It'll be just like it is now. The teachers will have their little Duval Teachers United cards, and they'll take them to the gun store, and they'll get 10-20% off of bullets and flak jackets like they're at Office Depot.
Let's get a few more calls on the air. Brian is in San Pablo. Hi, Brian. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, I just got two comments, really. Kids don't get in fights in school, so, that's being sarcastic. But, I mean, what happens if a kid challenges one of the armed officers? And what happens if one of the armed officers accidentally shoots one of the kids? Or what happens if, you know, the guard has his gun taken from him from a kid? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, all it takes is one fiasco to happen that all this just blows up in everyone's faces. And it's at the tragic end of these children. You know, and I just think it's horrible. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. And I think his point of view is basically the same argument that the state's teachers are making.
But yet, take a look at the statistics for Jacksonville's homicide rate and the number of victims that were under 20, a large number of them in 15, 16, 17. And look at the suspects that have been arrested for homicide in the past few months, also 15, 16, 17. The potential for someone with serious gang creds showing up in a school to fix a fight with a gun, I think, are fairly high in certain parts of the city.
John sends a message to our Facebook page. Hire veterans to do this. They have the training. Catherine emails the show. Don't forget what happened at Jacksonville's Episcopal School. That was the site of a deadly school shooting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Melissa, another interesting thing about it, and when we talk about veterans or police officers doing this work and protecting kids, you know, teachers are all about embracing children. We're now beginning to think about teachers in a school as the first line of defense. But what do they do when this happens? They gather the children. They try to put them in a safe place. They don't run to the shooter necessarily. Yeah. They don't see
They're
young people.
They're thinking about protecting the kids.
Right, and they don't see young people as the enemy. So my job is to shoot you. And so I think the psychology mm-hmm. of what's happening to all of us is really strange.
That's an important mm-hmm. point. Doug is on the South Side. Hi, Doug. Are you a teacher?
Yes, I am. I'm currently a teacher. Yes.
Where do you teach?
Well, I'd rather
not say. Okay. Well, what do you think about all this? What are your thoughts?
So I'm a veteran, 23-year military veteran, 5 combat deployments. I did the troop to teacher program so I could keep on serving. For me, it was the best way to keep what is deeply ingrained inside me, service before self, all that. However, the state inside, the security inside the schools is absolutely abysmal, I will say. And I will also say that, things happen that, never make it outside of, because nobody wants things in the news are reported. So it's actually a lot worse than what you may even imagine. Mm-hmm. And I know, gang creds and all that, there was recently an incident where a student just got killed, got shot. and shot by a fellow former student. And I mean, so the, it's, I mean, the gang creds and the ties. And then, too, another thing that's frustrating for me is a lot of overage kids, you know, kids pushing 19, 20 years old, just keep going through the school system. They have no intention of graduating, but it's easy access to a lot of things. And
So, Doug, what do you think about the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas report and the findings and the recommendations?
Well, I mean, it's parallel. I mean, it's it's such a soft target. Even after all that that happened almost a year ago, I see almost no improvement or no change.
Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that. I'm really sorry to hear that.
And it is literally, yes. I've done five combat deployments, but there are days when I go to work where, you know, you feel that adrenaline, kind of like that sense of danger, whatever, like, you know, that's around inside of me. So I've always got like that heightened, you know, I was in Afghanistan in 13 months. So
yeah.
I've got that same thing and all around me, you know, I'm trained to look for.
One more question for you, Doug.
Can I ask you a question, Doug?
Sure.
Were you in the Army when you served in Afghanistan?
I was actually in the Air Force, but I was tied with the TAC-Ps, where we were outside of the wire all the time. So we would go in and like, and check for when the A-10s had to come in and drop bombs. So we were like embedded in the villages. And stuff. So I was, you know, always around that.
Well, let me ask you this, based on your experience as a teacher and as a combat veteran, say this proposal goes through and we do begin arming teachers in schools. As a veteran, what kind of weapon would you recommend for a teacher to have as their personal sidearm in the classroom? And would that be any different for an elementary school versus a high school versus a college professor?
Personally, I mean, and this is something that I've thought about quite a bit. So I do have a concealed carry permit, and I do, as a responsible gun owner, I do go to the range once a week and practice and everything.
So we're running long on time, Doug. What quick answer, and then we're going to move on and take some more calls.
All right. No problem. I would say probably something like a 380 that could be strapped to an ankle and completely concealable, but able to be used as a last resort.
All right. That's Doug. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Calling from the South Side, a teacher and a veteran. This is madness.
You know, he said something about
and not what Doug's saying, but that we're getting to the point saying what type of gun should an elementary school teacher have?
That's an important question because a lot of the teachers are, you know, maybe old ladies or, you know, it's like a pin. Every person has their own distinct thing. And, you know, it raised the question of if we don't even trust the teachers to decide what their own curriculum is or decide what questions are going to be on their students' test, are we supposed to trust them now with the power of life and death?
Well, here's an email from a Douglas. Tallahassee will not fund the teaching of cursive, but they will put a Glock in every classroom. Cherry.
Well, I think David started us by saying, you know, whose interest financially is being served? Why does the NRA gun lobby, want this? And I think Sheldon's quite right. Any legislation is going to dictate exactly what kind of gun a teacher can use.
Let's go to Andrew in Mandarin. Andrew, we have another Army vet and a teacher on the line. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, good morning.
Go ahead.
As I said, I am an Army veteran and a former National Guardsman and a teacher, and hopefully I can retire here in a few years. And I would just like to say that putting guns into the classroom is an exceptionally bad idea for so many reasons. Your panelists are much better qualified at specifying those than I.
And I wouldn't know about that. I think you could do just as good a job, if not better, since you're living this. So please tell it real quickly, why do you think it's a bad idea?
It completely changes the relationship between teacher and student, and in a very adverse manner. And this is with all the teachers, whether they have weapons or not. It no longer becomes a learning environment.
I think that's such an important point, Andrew, and I'm so glad you mentioned that. He's right. He's absolutely right about that.
Well, there's a breach of trust there, right? Mm-hmm. You for a lot of these at-risk kids, sometimes gravitating towards a single teacher can be the difference between flunking and actually making something of your life after high school. And if that trust, if that opportunity is not there anymore, then what do you have? Where does that kid go?
But it's not just at-risk children. I mean, as we all leave home and go to school for the first time, the most important adult in your life is your teacher, outside your family, outside your neighborhood. So it's that experience of your world expanding, and who do you trust? Who's your mentor? Who's your guide?
And let's remember the student. Recently, there was a teen-led seminar that was held, a public hearing, about crime. And the one thing I remember one kid saying was, I go into a classroom now, and the first thing I do is look, how do I get out? I like teacher A's room because I can get out. There's two exits in the closet. I don't like teacher B's room because there's only one exit. That's a scary way to go to school.
It is. Let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on. It's Kathy in Orange Park. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, mine's a little offbeat comment, I guess you might say, because I have no children there, and my grandson's only two, so who knows what it's going to be like by the time he gets there. But I'm old enough to, I was at the tail end of the Cold War, so like I said, this is a little different. But I loved school and graduated actually second in my class later on. But the first 2 years, first and second grade, we used to have where we had to go under our desk and have things. And I was scared to death, and I really was. I was afraid to go to school, but I loved it, but I was afraid. And that's just what I was going to say. And learning with that, I'm over 60 now, and I still get fear when I think about that. So especially with the elementary children, I think you have to be really careful. And I know they have to have drills, but especially with the elementary children, like they said, you know, if I'd seen a gun, I would have probably just jumped out the window.
Jeez, Kathy, thanks for that, and thanks for that reminder. The Cold War era with kids hiding under desks is a decent analogy to this.
I had to do
this.
That because I am that old.
Both Sherry and Dan had to do that.
You know, one difference I will say, you know, I graduated from Fletcher High School in 2007, and we always had drills, but it was always you'll never really use this. I can imagine in today's high schools, we actually need to pay attention to this because this really could happen.
Well, you know, the drill thing is really interesting. If you read the report coming out of Stoneman Douglas, they talk about this Code Red, and a lot of people inside the school, students and teachers alike, some of them thought it was a fire drill. Mm-hmm. So the thing about the communication, one of the callers, Melissa, who said we're really not ready, that's the big takeaway to me from the report, whether folks agree with everything in it in terms of the recommendation side. We are not ready, and the lack of communication.
And we're going to move on now. I know that it's such a hot topic and lots of calls on this, but
maybe
there are some other
paddles.
Yeah, I remember the paddle.
Oh, yeah.
There were still paddles when I was in school. But there's lots of other news that happened this week. And if you're just tuning in, it is our Friday Media Roundtable. Give us a call and join us at 549-2937 as we talk politics for a moment. Also, over the last week, more intrigue in the local mayor's race, if indeed it will be a race. The other day, Mayor Lenny Curry released what critics have said is a misleading attack ad against his possible challenger, City Councilwoman Anna Brochet. She has yet to file to run for office or to respond. But, of course, the election is just 60 days away. Early voting begins first week in March, I believe. And at the same time as all of that has been going on, City Councilman Terrence Freeman filed to run for the at-large Group 1 council seat currently held by Brochet, even though critics say he doesn't meet the residency requirements. Outgoing Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi also weighed in on our local mayor's race. She endorsed Curry for re-election. So with 60 days until early voting, is Mayor Lenny Curry a lock to be reelected, or will he have to fend off a challenger?
I would not say he's a lock, but the longer that Anna sits on the sidelines and debates this, the more momentum he gets. She released a statement a couple of weeks ago, a pretty seething statement of the mayor, calling this, you know, the Curry crime wave, all of this. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that Tim Baker, which is, you know, Curry's political consultant, his campaign chair, they were likely sitting on this commercial for quite some time, waiting for her to throw a shot out or waiting for her to actually file. Now, there are some people who say, you know what, wait as long as you can and then get in there and hit them hard and just get right in front of people for that short amount of time and try to get him
the qualifying deadline to run is coming up next week. It's January 11th, mm-hmm. just FYI.
Yeah.
Mm. So if Anna Broche plans to run or anyone else for any office, they have until then to do so. Shelton.
Well, you know, what I'm really hoping, you know, we need, you know, more electoral oversight, you know, election reform, whatnot. What I'm really hoping is that we can get Oprah or Dr. Phil down here to settle this down, because right. really this only...
Clearly, we're dysfunctional.
I'm a pro wrestling fan, and to me, this only makes sense if they're friends. You know, as David said, Curry is basically a lock, but locks can be picked. The thing is, none of this makes any sense, in my opinion. I don't know what Broche is doing. I don't know what Curry's doing. I don't know why he needs all this money for a re-election campaign where he has no major challenger.
But and let's talk about that. Lenny Curry is the first mayor in the city's history to have a political action committee, which is opaque. And he has also raised $3 million for re-election, ostensibly, I guess, to just scare off any potential serious challengers.
Well, but defense is a good offense, and he already had the feel-good Christmas ad, and now he's got the Jeopardy ad. And obviously, he's getting word out there that if you want to come at me, come at me, because I'm ready and you're not.
And the ad was done as a mock-up of a Jeopardy game show,
mm-hmm.
Making accusations against Broche. Here's an email from Andy. Curry's pre-campaign manager may have made a mistake with his TV ad labeling Anna Broche as cruel and selfish. This could actually attract Trump voters to the Broche camp. He should remedy this by beginning to refer to Anna Broche as Little Anna, very low IQ.
So a little sarcasm there.
A little sarcasm from some of our listeners. But, it's interesting because the most watched election this spring in Florida is actually going to be here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. The rest of the state is kind of quiet. We have this weird calendar timeline for our city elections. We're going to be having an election when nobody else is. It's a little strange.
Well, and while the mayor's office race is certainly going to get attention, you've got a pretty bland city council, election coming up. I mean, other than Terrence Freeman, who, after months and months of rumors that he was going to run for seat one there, at-large seat one, it's like, he finally runs. There's a little bit of drama. The only other drama with city council is, does Katrina Brown still plan to run under federal indictment? And does Garrett Dennis plan to run for anything? He is the only other council member besides Anna that has not yet filed for re-election.
Well, the other thing about this, we heard former Mayor Bloomberg of New York City on NPR this morning talk about his resiliency grant, right, to St. Petersburg, was it? And he made this comment, which we all say we believe, which is local government is the most important government we have. Mm. We have the least engagement. We have the least coverage. All these people are running for city council. I've seen nothing in the press about it. And how the people are informed about this election is critically important.
Let me just say that we're going to make every attempt here at WJCT to interview all of the candidates for city council and air those short Q&As during our newscasts leading up to the first election, which is in March.
Yeah, and that's great, Melissa, because we need more coverage of this. We need to understand what these people stand for. So here's a cute little ad that's an attack ad. What is this election about? Let's assume, there are other candidates in this. I've seen nothing that tells us what people's positions are. Flooding is a big issue. Mm. People in the neighborhoods keep saying, what are we doing about resiliency and flooding? I haven't heard anybody talk about it, really.
And there's been some discussion at City Hall. We did have Council President Aaron Bowman on this program a week or two ago, and he said he's concerned about this. He wants to make Jacksonville a more resilient city. They're trying to put together a resiliency commission of some sort that will look at this issue. So he is the one city official that we've heard from here on this show who has said, yes, we're looking at this. But I think you're right, Sherry. Constituents are increasingly demanding this because it's so obviously a major issue.
But news coverage of late has been very issue-driven. There's been so many more things that have overshadowed what is, on the face of it, a quiet election campaign.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Shelton.
Yeah, it's nice to see Mr. Bowman stepping up and being kind of an adult in the room, because this election, I think the Lenny Curry, Anna Broche, Garrett Dennis thing, I think this is really a conflict that resonates with maybe about 1,000 people in this city, and the majority of people don't care. You know, most viewers watching that Anna Broche ad, you know, they probably thought it was actually Jeopardy. That's how much attention that they're paying.
And a lot of people probably outside of the people who follow politics and maybe in, you know, who follow what, you know, stuff that's going on the West Side.
Yes.
They don't know who Anna Broche is.
And this is a situation where for a reason, I'm not in City Hall that much for legal reasons, but I'm sure you guys could maybe explain to me what happened between Curry and Broche to cause this personal conflict that they have both deliberately chosen to make a bigger issue. The issue is not crime, it's not flooding or anything else. It is the personal conflict.
I believe the Taylor Swift song Bad Blood explains it quite well.
Well, actually,
Taylor Swift should run for mayor.
I think the question does a disservice to the voting public. I mean, what do they stand for?
Yes.
Yeah.
So make the assumption she gets in. Or there are what? There are 4 or 5 other people in this. Dismiss them without any kind of conversation.
But the question is not what do they stand for, but do they stand for anything at all?
Okay.
Well, I don't think we know yet.
As you pointed out, Shelton, it isn't something that, by and large, the general public is tuned into yet. However, this is something I think will generate a lot of calls. We want to talk for a minute about medical marijuana in the state of Florida. And give us a call if you think more people can benefit from medical marijuana and if you've had trouble getting access to medical marijuana, because a new report shows that the use of medical cannabis in this state is steadily rising. More than 136,000 people statewide got certificates to use cannabis in the first 9 months of 2018. But rolling out medical marijuana around the state has been slow for many reasons. Part of the reason for that is the federal government continues to categorize it as a Schedule I drug. The Rick Scott administration was very slow to allow more dispensaries to open, to allow more doctors to prescribe cannabis. So as we talk about this, what are your hopes for medical marijuana use in the state? And do you support full legalization as some states are doing? Give us a call on that at 549-2937. Shelton Hull, you write about cannabis in Folio Weekly. We now join 32 other states that have legalized medical marijuana. Lots of dispensaries around town, particularly Trulieve is operating them. Mm-hmm. Still, though, you know, it's been a long road for people to get access to this drug.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if you want to look at what the state, how the state is handling this issue, if you've ever been a kid and had your mom tell you to go clean up your room while all your friends are outside playing and you don't really do that good a job and you're just sweeping all your dirty clothes underneath the rug, that's essentially what the state is doing. Rick Scott was handed this mandate by the voters, and in typical bureaucratic fashion, he's opposed to medical marijuana, so what he would do is simply clog up the works. Now, the Office of Medical Marijuana Use last year had their budget flipped over like several times. I think it went from $3.5 million to $13 million, and a lot of that money is being spent on processing the cases as they go through. As your notes say, we're at about 136,000 medical marijuana patients. Now, if the system was moving along, if it was like, you know, oiled up the way it should be, we would be probably at or beyond 200,000 now. Hopefully, my colleague AG over Florida Politics and Folio, he's a big Nikki Fried fan, and he's noted that hopefully
the new agriculture commissioner.
Yes, her background with the with that lobby hopefully will put her in a position to get things moving along. And one would hope that DeSantis will be too busy, you know, avoiding indictment to.
So just cynical. Let's
crimes committed yet.
Nikki Fried campaigned on medical marijuana, won on that issue, and actually, Governor-elect Ron DeSantis, some advisors close to him say expect him to be much more moderate on this issue than Rick Scott.
I would expect that. I think Ron DeSantis sees that this is a fight that ultimately, you know, it's not worth, you know, sticking your neck out for. Rick Scott is probably going to be best, well, one of the things he'll be best known for is really, like Shelton said, clogging up the process. Florida is notorious for trying to reinvent the wheel. I mean, it boggles my mind when you consider how other states, Colorado comes to mind, have not only done this, but they've implemented it well. It's, you know, it's just, it's mind-boggling, but hopefully.
And making a lot of money.
Making a ton of money.
A lot of tax money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, look, in 2020, I could see this being a constitutional amendment to try to legalize recreational
use. That's absolutely a plan.
But it's like, how do you get to that step when the state has spent years dragging its feet on just trying to get the medical side of it done?
And, you know, with, you know, I think a big part of what Ron DeSantis will be occupied with the early part of this year, at least, is the Amendment 4 situation. And Amendment 4 dovetails with Amendment 2 nicely because so many of those felony convictions were for nonviolent drug possession cases. So the influx of new voters because of Amendment 4 will, I think, make it much easier to get full legalization on the ballot in 2020 than the medical was in 2018. And note also, Donald Trump himself said last year that he is not at all opposed to the idea of decriminalizing marijuana on the federal level. Whether they get that push through the Senate or not is unclear, but they have the numbers to do it in Congress. And if they can somehow make it more of a bipartisan thing, which is that is the direction it's going, Trump says if the bill comes before his desk, he might end up signing it.
Dan.
But two things quickly. Number one, take a look at the intake logs at jail, and you'll see that many, many suspects have what is as one of their minor charges, possession of marijuana.
Yeah.
So JSO is still out there. It is still on the books as a crime. Number two, this study brings out two interesting points. A minority of those who are seeking marijuana are doing it for what I would think would be the most logical pain treatment of cancer. The majority in some counties is PTSD, and the question is this, and I'm taking a big leap here, like opioid, you find the doctor who will prescribe it to you because you want it, not because you need it. And PTSD is an indefinable need.
And that is happening. Some people are gaming the system to get access.
Some of them are teachers with guns.
Sherry McGill.
Okay, that's not true.
Sherry McGill.
Well,
yes,
you know,
that is not true.
We can be funny about this. PTSD is a real serious issue.
Yes.
And more people, I think, in American culture suffer from it than we recognize. I think, you know, kind of on the funny side of this, Melissa, it's the demographics are interesting to me. It's who's against it. Well, I don't know anyone who's against it.
Part of it's strong bipartisan support.
Part of it's the aging of the baby boomers. And as we are burying our parents and moving into being the elders with a lot of considerable pain. And, you know, let's face it, we were the generation that experimented with this when we were kids, and I think we're just not that afraid of it.
And, you know, let me add, too, as Shelton pointed out, as the full legalization push ramps up in 2020, that's going to be interesting politically to watch statewide, particularly with President Trump on the ballot here in Florida. Advocates for full legalization believe that's going to bring out younger, more progressive voters that might not otherwise turn out. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, when you think about trying to drive up voter registration, if I'm the Republican Party and or the obviously the Democrats who had a pretty decent showing this time around, that's just an easy win. I mean, most young people, even if they don't smoke or whatever you do with it now, even if you don't partake. There's not really, it's kind of like alcohol. It's like, maybe I don't drink a beer all the time, but that doesn't mean I think it's bad or think that you shouldn't be able to drink a beer. I mean, we always talk about marijuana being this quote unquote gateway drug. Well, I mean,
that's been debunked though. Yeah,
I mean, I mean, it's not. I mean, it's like alcohol. I mean, it's, if you want to be a responsible adult, we give you the option to partake in certain vices.
Mm-hmm. I mean, coffee is the real gateway drug.
And you see it right here.
Yeah.
Now, then we're all in trouble.
I would suggest that President Trump, coming into 2020, if he wants to be reelected and he wants to maybe not necessarily pull in liberal votes, but tamp down a lot of the aggressive liberal turnout that will be happening, he could push his guys in the Senate to go ahead and embrace full decriminalization
on the
federal level.
And take that off the table as an issue.
And when he talks about the wall, he could always propose a deal where we decriminalize marijuana and use the taxes on the marijuana to pay for the wall.
You ought to be a political consultant, Shelton Hull. I think you might have a new calling out there.
I'm easy to find.
Let's go to Linda in Deerwood. She's been holding. Hey, Linda. Good morning.
Hey, I mean, the conversations have morphed a thousand times since I got on hold.
I know, but go ahead.
But I just wanted to say this kind of all goes into, it's about kind of like representation with the local elections I don't know how we determine that we're going to have an all-cycle quiet election. Who determined that? Why wouldn't we want the excitement of people going out to vote and us voting for mayor and city council at the same time? I know we said we don't want them to get drowned out, but they're not saying anything. So we could have actually had them on a cycle with other elections. And, you know, I think for the amendment too, they're going to do the same thing they did with medical marijuana. They're going to study it. They're going to have some whatevers because they don't want people to get their voting rights restored who they think aren't deserving.
Oh, you're talking about Amendment 4. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Amendment 4. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all about our government. And if it's quiet, why aren't we demanding that they get out there and sell themselves? I wasn't impressed with Mayor Curry's or his PAC or whoever's, you know, Anna Brochet commercial. I thought it was petty and it showed that he's a bully and kind of scared. Anybody but Lenny. Thanks.
You know, Melissa, I think that Linda makes an interesting point that we haven't touched on, and that is the state legislature's determination to defy the will of the people in Florida. So we've seen this over and over. So we've been talking about marijuana, but there was before that Forever Florida. And what really intrigues me about this state is...
Which was the land preservation.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not talking about slim majorities on these votes.
Right.
And I'm not arguing for direct democracy, but we have a situation in this state where she said they, I'll call it the power structure, says, we don't want to do that, so yeah, we'll study it to death, and it'll go away.
Just
or we'll
ignoring the will of the voters.
Yeah,
time
and so
time
then
again.
What do voters do?
Yeah.
We say, well, I guess we have to amend the Constitution,
yeah,
and so we go through that expensive grassroots effort, and they say, nah, I don't think so. Yeah. That's fascinating to me.
And it's been happening on many issues. You're right about that. Not a new phenomenon in this state, so...
Yeah.
Think about your issues and cast your ballot accordingly, because that's the only way to change that dynamic. Okay, real quickly, let's do a lightning round as we kick off our first ever lightning round of 2019. What are some stories we might have missed this week? Let's start with you, David Cotton.
Oh, exciting. I know I've been on vacation this week, but, you know, like most in the media, you can't unplug. Great news for downtown Jacksonville. We got the first look at what Vistar Tower will look like. Can see that on jacksdailyrecord.com. We got all the new renderings of that.
Okay.
It'll be great.
Lovely. Dan Scanlon?
Got a big story this weekend coming up, but here's the tip. We've had 11 less homicides in 2018 than 2017, but
awesome.
We also had 17 of those in December, a very violent December in this city.
Unfortunately. Shelton Hall?
Speaking of violence, All Elite Wrestling was just founded this past week. Tony Khan, son of Shad Khan, is partnering with Cody Rhodes, son of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. They're doing their first rally at the TIA Bank Stadium parking lot on next Tuesday, which is the same day that WWE is bringing in their SmackDown show.
Nice.
So expect...
Let's get ready to rumble.
There could be actual fight.
All right. And yeah. Sherry McGill.
Well, very excited about Steve Atkins' development of the Barnett Tower. I think that's just a game changer for downtown. We've known that for 30 years. It's taken a long, long time to do it. But a shout out, honestly, to nonprofit financing of that project. The TU did a great job in that lead editorial talking about LISC. There are an unsung hero in
all
this
right
community.
Thanks for all of that, and thank you for coming today, David Cotton, Shelton Hull, Sherry McGill, and Dan Scanlon. Guys, have a great weekend. We'll see you soon.
You too.
You too.
You too,
Melissa.
And don't go away. Still ahead, a look at a growing trend here on the First Coast, the use of influencer marketing and how it can help your business. That's right after this.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. This holiday season, let's make sure that our presents for the kids we love aren't headed to the island of misfit toys.
More at terrellhogan.com.
WJCT is seeking creative, innovative, and informative sessions for our Teach Conference on Saturday, March 2nd. Presenters have the opportunity to connect with educators from across the First Coast. Go to wjct.org/teach.
2 weeks into the government shutdown, private businesses pick up the tab to keep parts of Yellowstone National Park open.
It should be open, and services should be there because it is the people's park.
They won't get their money back.
There is no reimbursement from the government if the shutdown ends. The funds that we pay operate for those days.
The shutdown and national parks this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week, Science Friday is for the birds. It's our annual Christmas Bird Count show. Tell us what you've seen in your neighborhood. And you know, you don't have to live in the country to see them.
And I look up and there's a snowy owl flying over our heads at 11 p.m. in the middle of downtown Portland.
Tell us what's in your bird feeder on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
No money, no wall, and still no deal. Congress convenes, welcoming a lot of newcomers. The president praises PBS and enjoys the big picture.
I had a meeting at the Pentagon with lots of generals. They were like from a movie. Better looking than Tom Cruise and stronger.
The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, this week, Visit Jacksonville announced it saw record-breaking tourism numbers in 2018. How did they do it? They used influencer marketing. More and more local businesses are doing the same, using influencers on social media and other platforms to help them promote their brands and products. So how does this work? Amy West is the president of North Florida Influencers, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. So happy to be here.
Good to have you. It was interesting just yesterday to have the president of Visit Jacksonville on this program saying, look, if someone has hundreds of thousands of followers on social media, we will pay them to post about Jacksonville as a way to drive tourism. Mm-hmm. Is that one aspect of influencer marketing? How do you define it?
Yes, absolutely. So my traditional definition of influencer, what an influencer is, because that's a big question that I guess people still don't understand what an influencer is someone who has a social media account that they've built a following, and now they use their taste to promote other brands' interests. So a brand will partner with them where it makes sense for their influencer brand, and they'll broadcast that to their audience.
And why are businesses increasingly putting their marketing dollars in this space?
Well, influencers meet the audience where they're at. So more and more of the younger audience, and honestly, you know, just a progressive older audience, call them the perennials, I've heard them called. So we're not just limiting them to the millennials, but also to an older generation that's just getting more technically savvy. Influencers are meeting them where they're at. More and more people are unplugging. They're not watching their TV quite as much. And so influencers are reaching them on their phones where they're at.
Okay, so there are different types of influencers. There's micro influencers and nano influencers. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
And macro, which is the giant ones. Yeah, so if you're a macro and mega have over 100,000 or over a million.
So that's Kim Kardashian, say.
Correct, more celebrities.
A celebrity.
Then your micro influencers are going to have maybe over 10,000, maybe 10 to 100,000. And your nano influencers are going to have under 10,000. So they're going to be your maybe hundreds of, you know, maybe thousands, somewhere in there.
But even if you're someone with less than 10,000 followers, a business may still desire you based on the quality of the people that follow you or are friends with you, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, a Forbes article I read recently was talking about in 2019, you can see the rise of the nano influencer happening. Because what you see with the smaller influencers is that they have a stronger regional following. So what we do with North Florida influencers is we're educating local brands on how to use an influencer. And so honestly, the smaller the influencer, the stronger the regional following will be. So you see they're also a little more affordable to work with. So if a brand wants to have a $10,000 budget to work with influencers, they can use more nano influencers instead of one mega influencer.
Okay, so your company is North Florida Influencers, and people may not realize there are a lot of influencers right here in our area.
Yes.
And you work with them.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I've been shocked to see how many we have because I've been doing this since 2012. I had a TV show that segued into a blog that turned into influencing because you had to use social media to help market your business. Well, we decided last year that we wanted to start creating a community where we could actually interact and get to know each other and compare notes. Well, now we have over 160 influencers regionally, and that list is growing weekly. And combined, we have about 2 million Instagram followers together.
That's a lot of followers.
It's a lot of followers, yes.
Okay, so is Instagram the platform we should all be focusing on the most heavily in 2019?
Well, it is the most popular. You know, Facebook's had its challenges in the last year.
Yeah.
You know, Twitter shut down Vine. Now they're talking about bringing it back. Pinterest is certainly growing. I wouldn't turn off all the other social media and think that Instagram's going to be the end all to be all because, as we've seen, social media is, you know, trendy, right? So trends rise and they fall. So I'm always looking for emerging markets. In fact, TripAdvisor just started their own social media. And so now you'll see a more niche group of travel influencers growing their following on TripAdvisor.
Okay, so what final advice do you have for a business that wants to get into this, but they don't know where to start?
Well, they can come to us, but definitely just start doing your research. Go to Google, you know, look at the influencer trends. Myself as a writer, when I was writing for USA Today, one of the things I found when I worked with local businesses is that many of them were a little bit behind when it came to just having high-res images, a website, a Facebook. Now you also have to have an influencer. So start thinking in terms of that, of, you know, who is it that I need to be connecting with to spread and broadcast my message.
And they're right in our backyard. They're not as hard to find as people might think.
Exactly. We have a great community. We have events every month where you can actually connect with them. And also our website, you can get to know some of our influencers on there.
And you conduct workshops too. So
indeed,
that'll be happening all through the year as well.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a brave new world of marketing, isn't it?
It sure is. We're really excited about what's happening.
All right. She's Amy West, the president of North Florida Influencers, and it's Influencer Marketing. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. And happy New Year, a little past New Year's Day. And that is our show. Thanks so much to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Also, don't forget to catch our new statewide show, The Florida Roundup, today at noon, where we talk about the biggest stories across the state. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.